Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Bacon Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. In just a minute, we're going to be speaking with Thomas Leitner about the genetic history of the domestic dog. And we're also going to be speaking to Bob Martin from the Lensic about the WPA Film Festival that's coming up at the Lensic. Right now, I'd like to welcome Bridget Lindquist. She is the executive director of the Española Valley Humane Society. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's good to see you, Mary Charlotte. You look well.
Oh, and you too. It's good to see you again.
Thank you.
And to have you back on the show. You are having a Wonderland masquerade. It's a benefit for the Española Valley Humane Society.
It is. It's our 16th annual opportunity to raise about 20% of our funds in a single evening. And this year we have an Alice in Wonderland theme, which is not to curtail those of you who want to be adventurous and just wear whatever the heck you want.
So it's a pre-Halloween Halloween party, essentially.
Exactly. Great chance to break out the costume, try it out with a rousing crowd, and see whether or not it's effective.
Can I come as Catwoman?
Mary Charlotte, you can come as whatever you want to come. I know I'm coming as the Drink Me Potion.
That sounds pretty interesting.
Yeah, well, any excuse to wear cork on my head is a good one.
So tell us what's happening at the Española Valley Humane Society these days.
I think the biggest program that we've implemented lately is our Helping Paws program, and that's in reaction to the recession. A lot of folks have begun to surrender animals because they can't afford to feed or care for them anymore. So we began doling out food, and people can come once a week and receive 40 pounds of dog food. I believe it's 20 to 30 pounds of cat food, and all they need to prove is that their animals are no longer intact. And if they are intact, we spay or neuter them for free. So it's the equivalent of a food pantry for an area that's especially hard hit by the economy.
And free spay neuter.
Free spay neuter.
Are people taking advantage of that?
In droves. In fact, we're having a hard time keeping up with the demand. I think even as I speak to you, I know to date we've doled out over 2,200 pounds of food. And we're probably down about 300 to 400. And we can give out as many as 500 in a week. So if anyone is interested in donating food to this laudable program, all you need to do is call the shelter, 753-8662, or we're happy to take checks toward Helping Paws, too. And the ultimate goal of the program is to start bringing our services to the community, food, shelter. We've been doing a doghouse build, and we essentially distribute those doghouses to those dogs who need shelter in their backyard. We'd also like to supply fencing. Because there are a lot of folks, unfortunately, in the Española Valley who subscribe to the idea of chaining their dogs.
Mm-mm.
And rather than showing up and just shaking a finger at them, we thought we'd show up and just offer them, you know, 5-foot-high fence.
That does seem like a more practical solution. Finger shaking has never worked on anybody I know, including me.
And yet, us Anglos love to do it. And I think that's kind of one of the challenges of being a predominantly white, do-gooder organization in a very Hispanic community. A lot of the Hispanics in the Valley care deeply for their dogs and are not folks that we're trying to change. So, you know, we walk this delicate balance between serving a community and not acting preachy.
So there is a lot going on. Are the people who are coming in for food coming in mainly for dog food?
Yeah, yeah.
I would think that cats, you don't feed them. They just go eat mice.
Yeah. Well, they do in your house.
No, I don't have cats in my house.
Yeah, they do just go eat mice or anything.
If I had cats, the dogs would eat them, and then we'd be back to square one.
A lot of people come for cat food and litter. We also offer litter to cat owners. But you're right. I'd say 80 to 90% of the recipients have dogs.
And so the Wonderland Masquerade is a gigantic Halloween party on Saturday, October 25th at 5:30 at El Museo Cultural. And that is right here in Santa Fe in the rail yard district. And we can't talk about prices on the air, but you can go to E Valley Shelter, the letter E, as in evalleyshelter.org, or you can call 795-9794. So tell us some more about the fun that's going to be happening this weekend.
We're fortunate enough to have Mira and Pomegranate Dance Studio come to do some belly dancing. For the early part of the evening, they'll have sort of a private exclusive show, and then toward the end of the evening, about 9:30, the whole ensemble will be on the stage. The part I'm looking forward to the most is Wise Fool. God bless Wise Fool. Thank heavens. We're so fortunate to have a troupe like them in Santa Fe.
They can do trapeze.
How did you get that? Did you get the memo?
No, I just have seen Wise Fool, and they do trapeze. I was a guest.
Yeah, and, you know, lest trapeze seem kind of stodgy to those of you who have seen it before, we insisted that they do a duo.
For whom has trapeze ever seen stodgy?
We insisted that they do a double trapeze. So that's what you're going to get to witness. They're also going to do an aerialist fabric act. And I guess the big advantage is we don't have stanchions to cordon off the crowds. Heck no. We have you within 5 to 10 feet of these performers. So
Excellent.
You have a front row seat to some spectacular talent.
Bridget Lindquist is the executive director of the Espanola Valley Humane Society. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's always a privilege. Stay warm.
You too. We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. We'll be talking more about dogs in just a second. I'd like now to welcome Thomas Leitner. He is an evolutionary biologist at Los Alamos National Laboratories and knows a great deal about the genetics of the domestic dog. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So you've done DNA research to determine the origin of the domestic dog. First of all, what's the difference between a domestic dog and a wild dog or a wolf or a coyote?
A domesticated dog is really a domesticated wolf. And genetically, they are very, very similar. While a coyote is a little bit further away.
Coyote and wolf come from the same sort of branch on the tree, perhaps.
Rather the dog and the wolf are in the same spot on the evolutionary tree, and the coyote is a little bit further away.
So dogs are basically domesticated wolves. What are the earliest archaeological records of domesticated dogs?
Some of the earliest are found in Europe and in the Middle East. They date back to about 12 to 14,000 years ago.
And are they mummified, or how do they know it's a domestic dog?
Well, there are skeletal features that one can distinguish dogs from wolves. Mainly that dogs are smaller and their jaws and look anatomically different.
And they're buried with their masters?
Yeah, in one case that was in the earliest find, actually, which is 14,000 years back in Israel, they found a young woman who was buried together with a puppy.
So the archaeologists dig it up and they say, okay, people had dogs 14,000 years. People kept dogs 14,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So the theory that, I went to your talk, which was very interesting, was that the archaeological theory was that dogs were domesticated in many different places, but your research shows something different, namely that all domesticated dogs come from one place.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us how you got there and where this place is.
The way we sort of addressed that question was to analyze the hypothesis that if all dogs were domesticated in one place, you would see a lot of genetic variation in that place on Earth.
Lot of dog genetic variation.
Exactly, a lot of dog genetic types.
And why is that? If all domestic dogs come from one place, why would there be so much genetic variation?
Well, this is under the assumption that there was more than one wolf, in fact, one wolf female that was domesticated. If there would have been only one female, you would have had less variation. But then there would still be more variation in that original place if it took a while before these domesticated dogs were moved to other places, because it would accumulate genetic variation there due to mutation processes, and then not all of those variants would be moved to other geographical places. But it turns out that actually there were many female wolves that were domesticated in this original place, which is South China, and not all of those variants were then moved together with human migration to Europe, to America, and back to Africa.
And so it's interesting because human beings originated in Africa, mm-hmm. and went all over the place. At some later date, in other words, there was a human migration to the area that's now China.
Yes.
and they started domesticating dogs, and then that group spread all over the world.
Yes. Yeah, humans moved from China also back to Africa, actually, and some went to the Middle East, and others went over sort of the north route over Siberia into Europe again, and then others went over to the America when the Bering Strait was closed.
And they always brought their dogs.
They always brought their dogs, yes. That was a very, apparently very important animal to them.
And so the dogs, the Chihuahuas and poodles and Great Danes and terriers and mutts that we all have in our houses and love,
yeah,
all originated in South China?
Yes. Yeah, that's right.
And so that's what your research has shown.
They were originally domesticated there. Some of the breeds were later bred in other places. And most of, some of the ones you just mentioned, most of them were bred in Europe.
But very recently.
Very recently, yes. In the 1850s and onwards.
And that's something we can get to in a moment. Some breeds are called ancient breeds.
Yes.
What are some of the ancient breeds?
Some of the ancient breeds are, for instance, the Siberian Husky. There are also a number of those Asian dogs.
Shar-Pei,
for instance, yes.
What a strange dog. I mean, when you think about breeding a dog that grows into its own skin, it seems like a very odd thing to select for.
Yes. I don't know how to respond to that, but that's a human, humans wanting a dog to be like that, and then by selecting which dogs can mate, the ones with the loosest skin, you will get offspring that has looser and looser skin over time.
We're talking to Thomas Leitner, evolutionary biologist, about the origin of the dog. So those are some of the ancient breeds, but as you said, there was a great deal of dog breeding in the mid-19th century that gave us all the just hopelessly cute variations that we know and love. What happened in the 1850s, do you know, that led to so much dog breeding?
I think you actually hit the spot when you said cute. Before the 1850s, there were, of course, dogs around, but most of them were what's sort of called working-type dogs. And they were loosely defined types of dogs that would help in herding and hunting and eating mice whatever.
Pulling sleds.
Pulling sleds, of course, yeah. And then in the 1850s, people started to think of dogs as more than just working workers. So they wanted to have cute dogs and lap dogs and dogs with particular looks. And it was sort of a fancy. It was what you can call the dog fancy, I believe, that they started to do this. And there were shows. And these are all the breeds now that are called modern European breeds.
It sounds like it's sort of a rise of capitalism phenomenon.
Yes, yes. I believe it was. What I've heard is that it was the middle class in Europe, in the UK and in Germany, that got more and more money, and they had less and less to do, so they got into breeding dogs.
Now, when you were studying, you're studying mitochondrial DNA and you're studying chromosomal DNA, what is the difference? Is there a big difference genetically between, you know, a dachshund and a Great Dane?
So on the mitochondrial level, which is the type of DNA that I've analyzed to ask the question of where the dog came from and when was it domesticated and how many female wolves and so forth. On that level, there are differences between dogs, but those differences do not follow the breeds, which means that basically all breeds came from this original mix of dogs. On the chromosomal level, and the chromosome is, chromosomal DNA is the DNA that actually determines how the organism looks, how long hair the dog will have, what kind of ears and how long the legs are and so forth. There are obviously differences, as we can see in the morphology of the dog.
You told an interesting story during your talk, which is that there was a forensic question, which is that if somebody committed a murder and dog hair was found on the crime scene, could they match the dog hair to try to solve the crime?
Right. So that was how this whole study really started. We wanted a method of how you could, if you could, that could identify dog hairs found on a murder victim to dogs that suspects might have had. And the chromosomal DNA, as I said, will have that kind of information, although no one knew that at the time when we did this about 10 years ago. The chromosomal DNA is very difficult to extract from the hair shaft. So we went for mitochondrial DNA.
Which is easier?
Which is much easier because there is much more of it. Each cell has lots and lots of mitochondria, and each of those mitochondria has a DNA instead of just one chromosomal piece of DNA. But unfortunately, the mitochondrial DNA couldn't help us in that pursuit. But then that's how we started to look into the evolution of the dog instead. And that was fortunate for us, but unfortunate, I think, for the forensics.
So the archaeological record, as you were talking about before, has put pet dogs together with people 14,000 years ago. What is the timeline that your DNA studies have turned up in terms of how old the domesticated dog is?
The latest studies agree very well with that. We can say that the dog or the wolves were domesticated less than 16,000 years ago. And that coincides very well with the archaeological record.
And so do we know, here are people living in South China 16,000 years ago. Do we know how they lived and what they were doing with their dogs, why they started domesticating them?
Yes. It's believed that the people who lived in South China, south of the Yangtze River, were the ones who domesticated rice. So they were hunter-gatherer people who became sedentary farmers. And at that time, they also domesticated wolves. And I believe that wolves existed in this region until about the 1950s. So now there aren't any wolves there anymore, but until then...
Until the 1950s?
Yes, they had wolves in this region.
And then they were exterminated?
I guess so.
One does wonder how a group of rice farmers can take puppies away from their mothers and start to mess... I know it's speculation, but what do you suppose that looked like?
Well, there is a theory that claims that perhaps it was wolves who domesticated themselves because these people who became sedentary had food scraps and garbage piles and so forth, and it would be easier for certain wolves to just go and eat the leftovers instead of go and hunt their own animals.
So they just said, "Hi, we're here. Can we be your friend? We'll clean up your garbage and eat your scraps."
Yeah, that's one of the theories. And it's called flight distance. People have suggested that those wolves that had the shortest flight distance, which is the distance at which animals feel comfortable eating in human presence, were the ones that became domesticated. And I'm sure... to me, that's a plausible theory, but it must have been a combination that the humans allowed that, of course.
Right.
And then chose those who were the nicest wolves to be around their home. And that was probably beneficial also for the humans, because they then maybe kept bad wolves away and perhaps also provided a protein food source for the humans.
So a group of friendly wolves would basically... keep the tribe safe from evil wolf predators.
Yeah, one could guess that.
And also, as you said, that when you say provided a protein source, they were eating them? People were eating the wolves?
Yeah, in this geographical region, they still do that. And it's known that they've done that since ancient times. So it is possible that this, in combination with the wolves, the friendlier wolves coming close, was one of the reasons why they were domesticated.
It is a funny combination, having your pets and eating them.
Yes, but this is not completely unusual. It also occurred in in the South American cultures where they had holy dog, the various holy dogs, and they were also used for food.
Now, the Australian dingo is an interesting case that you mentioned the other day, which it's a wild dog that cannot be domesticated, that is descended from a domestic dog.
Yes, that is a little bit funny. That's believed to be because the dingo, which domesticated Australia about 5,000 years ago, lived in a wild setting without humans interacting with them for about 5,000 years. So maybe they sort of reverted back towards more wolf-like wild behavior. And in the few hundred years since Europeans at least came back to... they didn't come back, but since Europeans came to Australia, that has been too short time to sort of re-domesticate them. This is somewhat unknown, but this is basically just the way it is.
Now, there's been some mapping of the dog genome. This is potentially useful, I guess, for understanding dog diseases. Does it have applications to human diseases?
Yes, people believe that since we can, if we can understand the genetic diseases that have formed in different breeds, maybe that can help us to understand human genetic diseases. Exactly how that's going to be done, I think, is unclear, but people are starting to do that now. And although it's not identical for very similar diseases between dogs and humans, it still helps us to understand what to look for and how to look for it and so forth.
And there is this interesting thing that both human beings and dogs have, first of all, a huge amount of genetic variation and a lot of genetic defects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the case of the dogs, that is probably because of these breeds. They are, so to speak, closed gene pools. You're not allowed to mix in any other breed into the pedigree of a certain breed. And that's an advantage for us because now we know that within this gene pool, if there are genetic diseases there, they should also be in all the in many of the others of that pool. And if you have another gene pool of another breed that is somewhat similar to that dog, and if that this other one now also has the same genetic defect, you can start to map which genes are responsible for these diseases.
Whereas if everybody were a what we might call a New Mexican brown dog or a wolf, it would be harder tracking for genetic.
Yes, but it would be better for the dogs probably because many of these genetic defects are recessive. And only when they come from both the mother and the father, they will make it through. But if they are mixed with lots of other gene sets, then they probably won't have an effect on the organism.
So now that you've determined where domestic dogs come from, what are you working on now?
Well, most of my work actually is not in dogs. It's in HIV evolution and... in understanding how HIV evolves and what effects that may have on the human disease progression and also on how to track the disease over the world.
Well, maybe we will talk about that another time here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Yes, I would love to do that.
Tomas Leitner is an evolutionary biologist at Los Alamos National Laboratory. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break right now, and when we come back, we'll be talking about the WPA. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like to welcome now Bob Martin. He is the general manager of the Lenzing Performing Arts Center here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Great to be here.
And joining us by telephone is Tom Nastic. He is the producer of public programs for the National Archives in Washington, D.C., and he will be here in Santa Fe this coming Saturday, October 25th at 7 o'clock, to introduce the film festival that's happening at the Lenzing, which is the commemoration of the 75th anniversary of FDR's New Deal. A whole bunch of films from that era have come out, and they're going to be shown right here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, Tom.
Yes, hi. Nice to be here.
It's great to have you on the air.
Let's
start with Bob Martin. You are interested. You're not only general manager of the Lenzing in here in Santa Fe, but you know a great deal about the WPA.
Well, a certain amount. I was working on a PhD a long time ago, and a lot of that work revolved around the art and culture and politics of the 30s. So, and there was an exhibit for the Federal Theater Project. For years and years and years, all the archive material from the Federal Theater Project was in a warehouse in Baltimore. It wasn't until the mid-70s that they actually uncovered it and started bringing it back out. So I was involved early on with that and brought an exhibit of work out to California, to Berkeley and Santa Cruz and UCLA. So I've always been fascinated by that time. And Kathy Flynn, who is the director of the New Deal Preservation Association here in Santa Fe and a wonderful, wonderful woman, and has done great things for New Mexico and the country to preserve all the work with the New Deal. We become friends over the years, and she was actually the one that led me in Tom's direction about this work that the National Archives has done on the old New Deal films.
So let's talk about some of the New Deal films. Tom Nasik, how did the government in the 1930s get into the film business?
Well, it was sort of an offshoot of the work that the Resettlement Administration and the Farm Security Administration began to document and promote their programs using. It started out in still photography with people like Dorothea Lange and Ben Shahn and others. And Rex Tugwell, who was the head of the Resettlement Administration, decided that that effort should be expanded into the area of film. And that brought him in contact with Per Lorenz, who had written some very complimentary articles on New Deal agriculture policy, and then was brought to the attention of Rex Tugwell, and the two met, and Rex Tugwell proposed a series of short films to promote the policies, and but Per Lorenz had something a little more grand in mind, and he wanted to make films. He called, his term for them were the films, a film of merit, and basically it was a government film that could compete creatively with films that were being put out, you know, by the Hollywood studios. So that was the genesis of the classic film, The Plow That Broke the Plains, which we'll be showing on Saturday night.
Tell us a little bit more about that film. I mean, when you, some of the films I was watching online, and they really feel like nothing more or less than propaganda. Did this film hold its own as something more than that?
I believe so. I think it. I mean, obviously, it's a film designed to promote government policy, but I think it sort of rises above, you know, just propaganda. Sometimes has become a derogatory term in a way, but I think creatively and the way it uses music and the way it uses the spoken word from Per Lorenz and the editing, I think in a lot of ways it rises above that and becomes a classic of the American documentary.
Have these films been seen much since the time that they were produced?
A lot of them have. Certainly The Plow and the River are considered American classics. The City, another film we're showing Saturday night, has been shown quite often. In fact, all of those films, The Plow, the River, and The City, are on the Library of Congress's National Registry. So they've been, you know, deemed as basically American treasures that are going to be preserved for all time. And so, yeah, they have been. Other ones we're showing, The Road is Open Again, which we're going to open with Saturday night, is probably not been seen very much. So, you know, we're giving the people sort of a mixture of classics and maybe some more rare films.
In what context were they seen in their time? How were they distributed?
It kind of depended on the film. Most of them, they were all shown in commercial theaters, either as short subjects or, you know, on double bills with other films. Basically, you know, films like The Plow had a very hard time getting a domestic release. Per Lorenz had to work very hard. In fact, he had to call in some Hollywood connections to get that done. But eventually it was shown in over 3,000 theaters. He had more luck with The River because he was able to secure a distribution with Paramount Pictures, and it was shown on a double bill with Hollywood Films. And The City was actually shown first at the 1939 New York World's Fair and became very popular there, and then went on to enjoy some theatrical bookings, I believe.
One of the things that's very interesting about the film The River is that there's a tremendous awareness of environmental degradation as early as 1937.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's true. I mean, that was one of the very, effects of the Great Depression, or the causes of the Great Depression, was the environmental problems that were going on in the central and western part of the country and along the Mississippi River. And it's a very poetic look at the effects of the logging industry and improper farming techniques and those sorts of things that led to the massive floods that occurred along the Mississippi River.
And in the same way, in the film The City, there's a real awareness of urban problems and the problems of urban sprawl and the necessity for city planning.
Exactly. I mean, that was the purpose of that film, to show an alternative to the overcrowding and the hazardous conditions, particularly for children in the cities, and the idea that these planned communities, which was a New Deal idea, as an alternative to those, and eventually, I think it was the basis sort of what became known as the suburbs post-war.
And it's a little, I mean, it's such an interesting thing for us to look at now. The suburbs at that point seem to be a really good idea. For now, people are thinking that it's maybe not such a great idea.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. It seems to be there's kind of a going back now to, more communities that are more designed on the urban model, I suppose, with everything sort of close in. But at that time, because of the conditions in the cities and in the industrial areas, that certainly wasn't the case. I mean, this was sort of the image of the future that they were looking at.
We're talking to Tom Nastic of the National Archives in Washington, D.C., and Bob Martin of the Lensic here in Santa Fe. Bob Martin, you have done work where you were drawing parallels between the movements of the 1930s and the 1960s. Tell us more about that.
Well, there was a whole theater movement really out of both civil rights movement and out of the anti-war movement that came out of the 60s and 70s, the San Francisco Mime Troupe, El Teatro Campesino, Bread and Puppet Theater. And these were a lot of groups that I knew and I worked with, and I was fascinated by it. And actually, it started when I was an undergraduate at Berkeley, is that I was fascinated by the 30s as a political period, but didn't really have access to what was going on artistically. Even in the theater department at UC Berkeley, there was nothing about Odets or Elmer Rice or any of these people. So I actually worked with a history professor at UC Berkeley and started just on my own trying to figure out, what happened in the 30s. And it was amazing to me, and it's amazing to me still, that in probably the majority of drama departments around this country, there's no mention of what went on in the 30s. No mention of the group theater that, Lee Strasberg and Clifford Odets and Harold Clurman came out of. Really the start of the American voice in the theater. The Federal Theater Project did incredible pieces. Orson Welles worked in the Federal Theater Project, directed the Voodoo Macbeth, which I think there's some cuts of in one of the films coming up Saturday night. And he and John Houseman, after that, started their own company. So the richness, if you're interested in American theater, that started transcending European theater in terms of revival plays or Shakespeare or whatever, it really was the late 20s and the 30s that began, the first real American voice of American theater. So I was just fascinated to learn about it, to read about it. And I was also fascinated that it was a history that most people of my generation were not aware of. it was almost like, well, you know, we knew about Brecht and we knew how theater had translated to that, but I'm not sure that we knew so much about the Libby newspaper and some of the other with the Federal Theater or some of the amazing work. I mean, everybody had heard about Waiting for Lefty, but it's only when you read In the Fervent Years by Harold Clurman that you realize, I mean, what a powerful moment that was in American history, American theater, American arts. So I've always been, you know, interested in how social movements and what is going on culturally happen. That was what really brought me back to the period of the 30s. One other thing I want to say is we're so delighted that Tom is coming out, and I'm so grateful for him working with us, and he may mention this too, but these are actually reprints that have been made of all these films, and we really had to prove that the Lenzik was museum quality, that we had the equipment and we had the expertise and the ability to show these prints, because you know we still are trying to show 35 millimeter prints of films as much as we can. It's a lot easier to just show it on DVD, but we believe that there's an experience through film that is unique. So again, we're very grateful to the National Archives and to Tom that they are entrusting us to be able to do this event this weekend.
Well, I'm grateful to you, because watching a beautiful, you know, super fine grain black and white film on DVD is just an unhappy experience. By the way, I have to say, we interviewed Susan Quinn, who is the author of the book Furious Improvisation, How the WPA and a Cast of Thousands Made High Art Out of Desperate Times, for an hour this past summer on the program, and I was amazed to learn how many of the artists who we know of as famous theater and film artists came out of this WPA work. And I wanted to ask Tom Nastic, who are some of the artists whose careers were fostered by the WPA film project?
Well, there was several cinematographers, Floyd Crosby, who went on to work on such films as Casablanca, and incidentally is the father of David Crosby of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, who has worked on The River. Virgil Thompson, who wrote the music for The Plow and the River, very famous pieces for both. They're both performed still today. They have become American classics. Went on to, become a major contributed to the American music scene, and as Bob mentioned, the Federal Theater Project. I mean, Arthur Miller, Elie Kazan, Mark Blitstein, so many names. I believe Burt Lancaster began in the Federal Theater. So yeah, it was a definite starting point for many people who went on to careers in Hollywood and in the arts.
And you also have the writer Lewis Mumford, is he actually the narrator of the film The City?
The City? No, he's not the narrator, but he worked with Per Lorenz on the script of the film. It's based on his writings, having to do with planned communities as an alternative to the cities, and he worked closely with Per Lorenz to write the commentary and the script for The City.
One of the things that was also very striking to me looking at these films during this particular presidential election campaign is that there's a lot of political talk right now about socialism as if it were Satanism or something. And, mm-hmm. and you forget that the United States has a strong socialist tradition that's very much manifested in these films.
Yes, that's true. In fact, it's amazing, not amazing, but I'm starting to think of renaming this series, using the motto of the National Archives, the What's Past is Prologue series, because many of the, things going on in the country right now, harken back to the 1930s and what was going on then.
Bob Martin, you were looking at the 30s, you're looking at the 60s. We're sort of in another cycle now, another 30, 40 years after that. Do you see parallels to those last two movements?
Well, I think it'll be very different because of the times we live in, but I think you can take inspiration from both periods. I mean, I think right now you certainly see a lot of people talking about where do you spend money. I mean, we have the biggest economic crisis since the Depression. We didn't plan this program 4 weeks ago. We've been working on this for about a year. So the irony of the timing I think is pretty amazing. People are talking about let's reinvest in infrastructure. I mean, bridges, highways, all of those things. To remember, the WPA Arts Projects hired artists to do work. And it wasn't a granting program. I mean, it was very much like the CETA program under the Nixon administration. So I think what you're looking at
when
is...
When you say it wasn't a granting program, it was instead a job with a salary...
Exactly.
It ...and work expected of you.
You didn't apply for a grant through a nonprofit. You were an artist, and you got involved in one of the units of the Federal Theater Project or in the film or Writers Project or, you know, those kind of things. So it was work for pay, being acknowledged as an artist to do work and to get it out. And part of what happened in the WPA was that work got out in a way that had never gone before in rural communities and ethnic communities. Work was being done. Work was being seen in the arts. So I think what the parallel is that where are your priorities? How do you spend your money? And if you are going to reinvest in the United States, certainly the arts are a place that is never really given the fair shake it deserves in terms of the cost impact and I think the change impact that happens because of the work that artists can do in communities and either, you know, through an education process, through a creative process, an empowerment process. So, I mean, you know what? We need better roads and we need new bridges and we need more creative kids and we need people to believe again. So I think that the inspiration that you take away from a lot of the work that came out of the 60s and came out of the 30s and that we look at now is that, you know, how do you, again, give voices to those communities? How do you make it accessible? How do you give artists an opportunity to work? Because they're not asking to be on the dole. They want to work. So if you find the way that programs and other things can really almost harken back a little bit to what the spirit of the WPA was, instead of just sort of a granting thing and, you know, peer panels and all that, not to say that you still want to have that. You still want to give an artist, if you could, a grant just so they can pursue their work. But also the idea, again, of what happened in the CETA program. The CETA programs, ironically, under Nixon, probably did more to give artists work really since the 30s in a very different way than the NEA. And I think the other real call to action is that the National Endowment for the Arts really needs to come up with a real cultural policy about what the role of art and culture in this country has been, is, can be. I think that that has not happened to the degree that I think if it was taken on and it used some of those earmarked periods, cultural periods of change like the 30s and the 60s, and maybe say that we're maybe rebooting the 21st century in the next month or two and that the possibilities that exist are great, and you learn from history, and you learn from history what not to do and what to do.
I mean, the proposition that we learn from history is dubious at best.
Well, I think it is, unfortunately, but and I think it's because it's also something that happened. It's boring. It's when I started to come in the 30s, I can tell you I was never more excited. I kept saying, God, I wish I'd been alive then. Boy, I wish I was around then. I was very lucky that I got to know Harold Klerman a little bit and got to do some interviews with him, same with Lee Strasberg. And, I mean, these were extraordinary people. And there wasn't anything that anybody was doing in the 60s and 70s that hadn't already been done and thought of, you know, 30, 35 years earlier. It was just that we weren't aware of it. We didn't ask the questions. So I think you always learn. And then you take it to the next step. You use what you have now. I mean, we live in a technological time, so that the kind of things that are going to happen now are not going to be the same that came out of the 30s. They shouldn't be. But you can certainly, you know, learn, I think, from experience of exciting times. And I think the 30s really was one of those times.
Tom Nastic, you are with the National Archives, and you're the producer of public programs. When you think of archives, you think of dusty repositories that the lone scholars venture into. Public programs. Tell us more about the work that you do.
Well, I work for an entity here at the National Archives called the Center for the National Archives Experience, and basically we are the public programs arm of the National Archives in the Washington, D.C. area. We sponsor exhibits here at the in the building and traveling exhibits. We have an online presence with something we call the Digital Vaults, which is at our website, www.archives.gov. We have the William G. McGowan Theater, which I manage, and we do film programs and lecture programs and symposiums, and we also have a very robust education staff who do programs here in the building and all around the country. So it's all, you know, all harkens back to the holdings of the National Archives, some 9 billion pages of textual records and 20 million photographs and over 365,000 reels of film, among many other things. So That's basically what we do. We're a part of the mission of the National Archives, which is to make available to the public the records of the federal government.
And by the way, for those who are just tuning in, the WPA Film Festival is this Saturday, October 25th at 7 o'clock at the Lenzic. How did you decide to restore all these New Deal films?
Well, like Bob, I've started doing film programs here at the National Archives, the 30s has been one of my favorite decades to draw from, simply because of the amount of creativity in terms of the films, and sort of unusual for government product, and it's a tradition that carried on, of course, into the World War II era. But the genesis for the actual film festival began back in March of 2007. There was a meeting held at the Library of Congress here in Washington to discuss plans to celebrate the 75th anniversary of the New Deal, beginning of the New Deal legislation in 1933. And at that meeting, there were representatives from the National Archives, the Library of Congress, the National New Deal Preservation Association, and plans were put together for many wonderful programs. The Library of Congress did an all-day symposium in April of that year, and we March of that year, and then we followed up by putting together this film series and premiered here in the McGowan Theater in March, and then went on. Basically, we didn't want it to stop there. I mean, a lot of work went into the series, and we thought that since the 75th anniversary was a nationwide celebration, that with the help of Kathy Flynn at the National New Deal Preservation Association and Al Stein and others, plans were made to take it out on the road, and it began in Chicago. It played at Columbia College in Chicago, and then went on to play in San Francisco, and last month it was at the the Roosevelt Library in Hyde Park, and then Saturday night we'll be at the beautiful Lenzic Theater. So we're just thrilled that we're able to share these wonderful films with as many people as we can.
There's one film we haven't talked that much about called We Work Again, and
yes,
it's about African Americans during the Depression and
right.
The projects the WPA did to advance them. And I think one of the very interesting and important features of the WPA was that it was really non-racist or anti-racist.
Yes, that's true. We Work Again. It was a film that was made for the government by the Pathé Newsreel Company in 1937, and it's sort of a companion film to another one called Work Pays America, which is more on national WPA programs. But as you said, this We Work Again is focuses on employment opportunities for African Americans, and as Bob alluded to, it's a rarity because it has about 4 minutes worth of footage from Orson Welles and John Houseman's production of Voodoo Macbeth at the end of the film, which is just fascinating to look at, because for a long time it was thought that there was no visual record of that very important federal theater production, but this film, you know, proves that wrong. I think I'm not sure, but when I look at the footage, I think it was shot during a rehearsal, and it's just very interesting.
Do you find that at the National Archives, you go through your possessions and come across jewels that you didn't even know were there?
Oh yes, all the time. I call them my fishing expeditions when I go into the holdings looking for things. And when there's over 360,000 reels of film, not all of them are in the downtown location, but most of them are. You're constantly coming across things. There's a film that we're not showing at the Saturday night, but it's part of the overall festival called Dawn Strikes the Capitol Dome, which was a WPA film about WPA projects here in Washington, D.C. that was a real find. I thought it was just a fascinating film. So yes, that's one of the benefits of my job is finding little nuggets like that now and then.
Tom Nastic is producer of public programs for the National Archives in Washington, D.C., and he will be here this Saturday to introduce the program, which is the 75th anniversary of FDR's New Deal Film Festival at the Lenzic, Saturday, October 25th at 7 in the evening. And Bob Martin is the general manager of the Lenzic and rather an expert on the New Deal himself. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm very much looking forward to seeing everyone at the Lenzic on Saturday night.
We will see you then, and I also want to say a special thank you to Kathy Flynn for all the great work that she does.
Yes.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Brian Highhill for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan. We'll have a visit from local star Ron Hellman and Gunther Schuller's Journey into Jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Tomorrow, Robert Knott will be with us, not only speaking of the arts, but also talking about his new theater production, so that and much, much more on KSFR. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao.